Imam Khomeini doesn't hesitate in moving over with him.
Yeah. Yeah.
He finds that this is an opportunity not to be missed. And really and truly, where he, a lot of people may think, well, you know, some of our community people think, okay, I've studied 6 years, 7 years, let me go back to my community. No, Imam Khomeini wants to venture further in
I think this shows something about, even at Imam Khomeini, even at as a teenager, he shows great insight, great depth and wisdom in his decision-making of where he wants to go and study and what subjects he wants to study, because of course he's taking on the Hawza studies, the traditional Quranic sciences studies, but he's also learning mathematics, he's also learning other subjects as well, which shows a wisdom and an intellect superior perhaps even beyond his contemporaries, that exactly what kind of target, what kind of goals he wants to reach.
You see, but the goals he keeps those goals under control.
That's true, because he's always against the ego, isn't he?
He's against the ego. But he was of the a very important opinion that whoever is the leader of the Shia Ummah at a particular time should be the person responsible to dictate what the political environment should be.
Absolutely.
He did not venture out beyond his limits that
That's
he
right.
identified himself with in relation to the leader.
But that shows a great wisdom in there.
Not only just wisdom, but what it shows is the total nature of Shiite opinion.
True.
You look at Karbala,
yeah.
If you look at Karbala, and
the divergence is allowed there.
Not only just divergence, the fact that recognition of the Imam of the time. You know, you had Imam Zainul Abidin al-Islam.
That's right, because
ill and everything. Yet still, Hazrat Zainab says, "You're the Imam of the time. What should we do?"
And the other thing is that we have to point out that even Imam Hussein alayhi salam, who was a completely revolutionary character alongside his brother Imam Hassan alayhi salam, but if Imam Hassan alayhi salam stayed quiet during the rule of Bani Umayyah during Muawiyah's 20-year period, Imam Hussein was quiet as
And this is what we're learning from Imam, what Imam Khomeini had learned, that when you identify with the leader of the time or whoever it is, that Ayatollah Hayri, may be Ayatollah Hayri, may it be Ayatollah Bujedi at a latter time, you do not venture beyond that. You can guide and you can support, but you do not venture behind the authority.
And I think that the support of Imam Khomeini at that particular stage is also very, very important. As you say, it does speak volumes in itself.
Indeed.
But we are going to carry on with that in the next edition of the program, where we will go further into the scholarship of Imam Khomeini, and then later on the works that he starts to come up as an accomplished scholar. And of course, he also achieved his becoming a mujtahid at a very early stage in his life as well. But we'll get on to that at a later program. At this moment in time, my dear audience, thank you very much for listening, and I hope you've enjoyed the program as much as I have as well. So thank you for listening today. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and blessings of Allah and His mercy be upon you all.
French artist has placed the Eiffel Tower on a cliff using optical illusion on the famous landmark. In his work, street artist J.R. has removed the River Seine or Seine with an imaginary street that would go from the Trocadero to the Eiffel Tower. This work is a collage of several layers of paper which are not to last long due to the rain and the crowd that will walk on it. According to the artist's post on Instagram, the idea is to find a place perfectly reproducing the Eiffel Tower and have fun taking pictures by the imaginary cliff or jumping over the gaping chasm. Thailand, three sniffer dogs have joined the fight against the third wave of the pandemic in the country. The canines sniff hundreds of sweat samples per day to detect COVID patients who display no symptoms. The samples are from local medical volunteers as well as bedridden patients who are not able to show up at testing centers. Thailand Social Development and Human Security Ministry is in charge of collecting the samples and delivering them to a university in Bangkok where the dogs operate. So researchers say the dogs can detect a volatile compound secreted in the sweat of COVID-infected people.
The distinctive scent is what would appear after there's an infection. Different kinds of viruses will produce different kinds of scents, therefore they contain different smells. The canines are very sensitive towards scents excreted from human body, and they have better sense by hundreds of millions of times better than us humans, without even having to come into close contact with the virus.
Researchers say the dogs have a success rate of over 90% in detecting asymptomatic COVID patients. They say the canines have gone through thousands of samples since early May. Robots probably will never replace humans, but you must be worried they might steal your job in the future. A cook robot in Spain has risen to fame because of its ability to prepare paella, one of the world's most renowned national dishes. This robot is made up of an electronically controlled stove and a mechanical arm. It can put the already fried ingredients into the pan, add rice to it, and then stir it before pouring in the fish stock. The robot can prepare one paella at a time. However, all the ingredients have to be prepared and measured in advance. The Spanish company behind this product is trying to expand the robot's functionality.
They are designing what we have named Gastro Robot Menu, a robot gastronomic experience. Five chefs from the Basque Culinary Center are developing a five-course menu, so eventually we would take a seat in front of the robot and taste five courses designed by five important chefs.
Enrique says the product has already provoked interest outside Spain. He says some amusement parks and resorts in Japan already have their own paella robots. Paella masters believe the machine is a useful tool for chefs because they can cook many paellas at the same time. As the world continues to battle COVID-19, people are finding traditional and modern ways of remembering those who have lost their lives due to the pandemic. A public library in the US is commemorating the victims with an origami project. The Greenpoint Public Library in Brooklyn, New York City, has collected 1,000 origami pieces since April. Inspired by the ancient Japanese legend that 1,000 paper cranes can bring well wishes or healing, the library aims to promote hope and a sense of solidarity. The delicate handmade cranes, many of them from recycled paper, are now on display in the library's lobby. The staff hopes that each and every crane brings hope to the community.
We made this for the COVID Remembrance Day event, month-long event. Crane, in many cultures, especially in Asian culture, it symbolizes peace, love, recovery, and hope. And especially in Japanese culture, Senbazuru, 1,000 paper crane, is really significant. They believe that if one holds 1,000 paper crane, one's wishes come true.
The library has also asked people to come by and drop off their homemade origami as a memorial to the COVID-19 victims. It plans to keep up the display until at least the end of the summer. what was once an underground movement is now all the buzz. After a 17-year hiatus, billions of red-eyed cicadas are crawling their way above ground in the United States. These cicadas are known as brood eggs, and they are beginning to emerge from the depth of the earth in a dramatic fashion. These birds have been sighted in 15 eastern states of America. They are around 4 centimeters in length with unforgettable bright red eyes and iridescent wings. Experts say these insects don't hibernate. In fact, they grow slowly underground for 17 years before they emerge to mate.
There are several misconceptions about periodical cicadas. One is that they're locusts. They're not locusts. Locusts are grasshoppers. Cicadas are much more closely related to aphids. There's another misconception that cicadas are harmful. Cicadas are not harmful. They don't bite. They don't sting. They're not going to harm you or your pets, so you don't have to fear the cicada.
Michael says cicadas tend to thrive on the edges of sunlit forests where it's warmer. They live above ground as adults for about 3 weeks, long enough to reproduce before dying. They lay eggs inside young tree branches, which hatch a few weeks later to restart the cycle. This year's cicada class will bore into the ground and won't emerge until 2038.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
The Peruvian zoo has showed off two baby crocodiles that were born through artificial insemination. The zoo in Lima celebrated their birth 3 months ago. Zookeepers say the two crocs are in good health. The American crocodiles now weigh around 70 grams each and measure 26 centimeters in length. However, it's too early to determine the gender of the newborns. American crocodile is in danger of extinction due to pollution and habitat loss.
A French musician has come up with an innovative idea to end his pandemic hiatus, performing on top of a mountain in Swiss Alps. Tiho performed on a platform at an altitude of 3,000 meters. The 30-year-old artist braved sub-zero temperatures in April to perform. He also had to overcome his fear of heights. Tiho has not performed in public for more than a year due to COVID-19 restrictions. He says the lockdown offers him a good chance to become more creative.
I feel like I had a lot of creativity during this period because I was stuck in the studio and a lot of time to make music. So usually when I perform gigs and I don't have so much time to spend in the studio. So today, during these days, is like better.
A music production company organized the show. The small platform was taken up to the resort by helicopter. It took 4 hours to install the setting.
The Chinese version of the Titanic has been created to keep alive memories of the ship over a century after its ill-fated maiden voyage. The full-scale replica will soon be open to the public. It's part of a theme park in Sichuan Province, southwest China. The construction work started 6 years ago, involving over 100 workers. Around 23,000 tons of steel has been used to build a ship, which is 260 meters long. Designers hope that it will attract up to 5 million visitors a year.
The ship is located in the west part of China. It will attract tourists from the world. We estimate that the number of visitors will be between 2 million to 5 million in a year. This tourist volume should guarantee the return of our investment.
Everything in the duplication, from its cabins to the doorknobs, is identical to the original Titanic. Spending one night on the five-star ship costs around $150. The original luxury vessel sank in April 1912 after hitting an iceberg. Over 1,500 people died in the accident.
Animals living in the Paris Zoological Park will soon be able to see visitors again after months of just interacting with zookeepers due to COVID-19 restrictions. The zoo is preparing to reopen next week with limited numbers of visitors and obligatory health protocols. During the shutdown, the park welcomed over 60 new babies, including baboons, penguins, and flamingos. Experts believe the reopening will be, that is, will reawaken animals' curiosity.
Seeing public again will reawaken the animals' curiosity. They also look at the visitors. Some are very interested. You'll see the seals when they're with small children. It's part of enriching their environment to see a little bit of people, of diversity. So it's good for everyone.
The park, which temporarily closed last October, houses 2,500 animals of 234 species. France is now easing its COVID-19 restrictions and plans to reopen museums, zoos, shops, and cinemas on May the 19th.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Suratul Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful. And we brought forth for you thereby gardens of palm trees and grapevines, in which for you are abundant fruits and from which you eat.
وَشَجَرَةً تَخْرُجُ مِنْ
we brought forth a tree issuing from Mount Sinai, which produces oil and food for those who eat.
Dear listeners, in the previous program, we talked about the 19th verse of the chapter, فَأَنْشَأْنَا لَكُمْ بِهِ جَنَّاتٍ مِّن نَخِيلٍ وَأَعْنَابٍ. We produced for you therewith gardens of date palms and grapes. لَكُمْ فِيهَا فَوَاكِهُ كَثِيرًا. Wherein is much fruit for you, وَمِنْهَا تَأْكُلُونَ. Whereof you eat. So, plants and trees, in fact, all the creation is for the human beings to use. To reach the level of perfection that Almighty Allah has put that in our bodies. But we need that perfection in our lives, in our minds. Perfection in closeness to the station of the Almighty Allah's mercy. Anyway, plants and trees are created for human use. Among the fruits, some of them like the date and grape are special. But the Almighty Allah has supplied man with the material needs, just like date palms and grapes. So, the Holy Quran in the verse was enumerating the results of rainfall in this verse. We produced therewith gardens of date palms and grapes. There is much fruit for you, and whereof you eat. And also the next verse, the 20th verse, says, وَشَجَرَةً تَخْرُجُ مِنْ طُورِ سَيْنَاءَ. And a tree springing out of Mount Sinai, تَنْبُتُ بِالدُّهْنِ, which produces oil, صِبْغٍ لِلْآكِلِينَ, and seasoning for those who eat. Every climate and geographical area is suitable for a special type of vegetation. The verse says, وَشَجَرَةً تَخْرُجُ مِنْ طُورِ سَيْنَاءَ. A tree springing out of Mount Sinai. Some places are spiritually and materially blessed. Mount Sinai, for example, is the place where divine revelation had descended and where the olive tree grows, the oil of which is a divine blessing as well. So anyway, the verse seems to refer to a blessed tree, the olive that grows because of this very rain, and it implies that in addition to the gardens of date palm, the graves and other fruits, Allah has created a tree that grows on Mount Sinai.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
The verse says, وَشَجَرَةً تَخْرُجُ مِنْ طُورِ سَيْنَاءَ, and a tree springing out of Mount Sinai, تَنْبُتُ بِالدُّهْنِ, which produces oil, وَصِبْغٍ لِلْآكِلِينَ, and seasoning for those who eat. So, this oil and seasoning is used for those who eat. The interpreters of the Quran suggest two probabilities why Mount Sinai is mentioned in this verse. The first is that it refers to Mount Sinai itself in the desert of Sinai. The Holy Quran has described the olive tree as a tree that grows on Mount Sinai because the Arabs of Hijaz traveled through the dry deserts of this area. They tried to go north. The first area where they saw the olive tree laden with fruit was on Mount Sinai. Studying a map makes this matter quite obvious. The second probability, however, is that Mount Sinai or Tur is a descriptive word meaning a blessed and wooden or scenic mountain, because literally Tur means mountain and Sinai means blessed, scenic and full of tree. So these were the two probabilities regarding the interpretation of the Holy Quranic word Mount Sinai. However, the Arabic word Sibgh originally means color, but since when man eats his bread with a sauce, he usually makes it colorful, all kinds of loaves of bread eaten with sauce have been called Sibgh. The word Sibgh may refer to the very olive oil that is eaten with bread, and it could be also here to refer to all kinds of bread whose sauce is made from other plants. Anyway, in this holy verse, the Almighty Allah mentioned some of the blessings that originally come from water for the human beings. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. To all our brothers and sisters across the world, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You are listening to IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. The program is Islamic Upbringing, where we examine the questions and issues that parents have in the upbringing of their children. And to help us with our questions, we have our dear and beloved Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi. Salaam alaikum, Sayyid Abdullah. It's very kind of you to come over.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. It's a pleasure being here with you.
A lot of parents are worried about their children who, as they grow up, they might feel like it's cool if they're in the U.S. to carry guns, if elsewhere, knives. And generally, it seems that if you're violent as a child, you're respected more and everybody looks up to you, at least among the children's community. And parents are worried about that. They're also worried about how games might affect them and what generally they should do in order to keep their children on the safe side, on the right side of life. What kind of advice can we give these parents?
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajeem. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. There is no doubt that guns and violence is a major problem, especially for kids and grown-ups and teenagers these days. We seem to be bombarded with a campaign, be it from Hollywood, Bollywood, or whatever wood you want to be in. And the gaming industry, the music industry, everything is bombarding the kids and the youth with violence. And they try to give it a new look and make it cool and hip. And, you know, like you said, if you're violent and you have things, then you're good. And so this grows from a natural age because we are subjected to what I call a systematic brainwashing by Hollywood, the media, and especially now it got into our houses, which is games, right? So you see a child would spend hours upon hours on a console. All he's doing is playing violent games. And these games, basically, they're also very well designed, mind you. They're not just any game, right? So they spend millions of dollars on these things, if not billions of dollars on these things, right? So the child has to go to certain areas, he has to get certain weapons, and he has to, you know, kill certain people, and he has to drive certain cars. And for example, take GTA, for example. To build your reputation, to be someone recognized, and you get reputation points, it depends on how many people you kill, and how many houses you burn, and how many things you steal, and so on and so forth. So the whole game is based on corruption. Or there's like any like other games which are in the same in the same field, right, in the same category, which it just basically teaches you how to go on a rampage just for fun. So when you have a child who grows up with this notion, and I've seen a lot of kids who are like that, and I've seen them like even in real life, they actually kind of violent to themselves, or if they're not violent, they will talk about violence, right? So they, to them, it's cool. Like, I would do this to you, I would do that to you, right? In a very violent manner, because they see it, they experience it, they play it, they get joy out of it. So the more you kill, the better you feel, and obviously dopamine gets released in your brains when you kill people, because it gives you that high, and you become addicted to it. So naturally, the thing that you want to do in real life is to have a gun or have a knife and look cool, because right, that's how you've been seeing it all your life.
Okay, let's take a short break and we'll be back for further discussions on this topic. Don't go away.
When I was born, the first words that I had heard were the words of Allah being whispered through my ear. And as I felt Allah's presence in my soul, that day Islam took me in its fold.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing. We're talking about guns, knives, and violence, and how children are prone to that, and what parents can do to keep their children away from that kind of attitude, if you will. You said that when children see or are exposed to games, and a lot of games, now that I'm thinking about it, are all about violence one way or another, that encourages them to follow that kind of mentality. But the same kids are also living in the community, and they can see that none of the grown-ups or anyone else is behaving like GTA, for example. So is it really the games that are the problems, or is it something else? For instance, couldn't it be that children are heavily dependent and they all realize that? But when you take to violence, it's a symbol of independence, and that's what actually makes the child superior to their contemporaries.
It is a factor of things. We can't just play games for it, right? So we're saying now because kids get to spend more time with the console than anyone else. So let's say that's a major contributing factor, right? But there are other things that are at play. For example, the psychological well-being of a child and his mental state also plays a major role. For example, if the child is subjected to bullying at school, if the child is subjected to, you know, for example, domestic violence, I've seen, for example, I know cases where children had to get a gun because they feel unsafe from their father because the father is violent towards the mother and stuff like that, right? So, or they're trying to take a knife because the area they live in is not safe. So he feels that if he wants to go from A to B, he needs to have a weapon of some sort just in case he gets attacked. So there are number of factors could contribute to the kids carrying guns or carrying knives or weapons of some sort that could harm others. So that's one thing. But sometimes what we're talking about here is just their lust for weapons, right? They just want to carry weapons just to look cool and be good and being gangster themselves. That's a problem. See, sometimes I could carry a gun or a knife out of fear for my own safety, which is just a natural response. But sometimes when I see my child having a knife in his bag, for example, just even though he's safe and he lives in a safe environment just so he could look cool, that could be a problem. I need to find out what led my child to go and resort to the fact that he needs to have a weapon in his bag or in his pocket.
So that warrants the parents to look at the community that they're in. That's probably the most effective factor.
So the community you live in, obviously, is a factor. For example, the school your kids go to, this is his second home, right? So you need to look at this school and what kind of friends he hangs around with, what kind of community he is surrounded by. So if you live in a community where violence seems to be okay, then obviously they're going to get affected by that. And if the community itself doesn't have that much violence, obviously there isn't much violence happening. But that does not mean that the child himself would not move towards trying to obtain a weapon himself. So even if the community is safe, because of his own feelings, for example, he wants to look cool. He disregarding the entire community. The community could be safe. Because, you know, sometimes we live in a community which is safe, and then all of a sudden you hear a story of someone getting killed or someone and you're like, how could that happen in such a community? Well, obviously because, you know, I have tendencies, but maybe I'm not acting on them, but the tendencies are there. But when you give me a motive and you give me the weapon, then disaster could take place.
Happen. All right. After the break, we're going to talk with Sayyid Abdullah and ask for some solutions, some ideas about what parents can do to ensure that their children don't go that way. Don't go away.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing with Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi. We're talking about guns, knives, and violence, and how to prevent our children from going down that road in life. So at some point in life, it's cool, and sometimes there's a predisposition for the children to become violent. Generally speaking, Sayyid, what advice would you give to the parents out there, or the community members who want to help the children of their community, to prevent those children from going down the road of violence?
Well, we always begin with awareness, right? This is a prevention. So you need always to start before you have the problem. It's like we always end up calling the police after the crime has happened, right? How about we call the police before the crime happens? So we need to have that prevention methods before we have this issue. So as in a community, for example, as parents, when it comes to weapons, obviously the result of these weapons is someone getting hurt or someone getting killed, God forbid. We need to bring them and educate them, at least from an Islamic perspective, that, you know, the value of life itself to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, how valuable life is, that you should not take anyone's life. It's not as easy as going to a game and is the more you kill, the better. No, because that goes against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants. Allah has gave value to the human life. And we need to teach our kids that human life has more value, is very sacred, that killing it is pretty much you condemning yourself to hellfire for eternity. So this kind of mentality we need to bring in our children. That's one. Two, harming other people itself. That harming them physically or mentally itself is also forbidden in Islam, and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has prepared punishment for those who indulge themselves in things like these. So that kind of, if you bring your children with this kind of mentality that you should not harm others, you should not, you know, harm them or kill them or what have you in any way, shape or form, and they grow up to that, then they will automatically don't find the need to carry a weapon. They don't find the need to carry a gun or a knife or whatever it might seem to be cool, because they understand that the purpose of these things is just to hurt people. I don't need to hurt people. For example, I speak for myself. When I was a child, I used to watch a lot of movies, and I liked, you know, I liked, for example, The Matrix and long coats and black glasses and, you know, just looking cool and having a lot of guns. And as a child, I was looking, trying to find, you know, trying to buy guns at like toy guns, trying to look cool as well, trying to be The Matrix myself or Blade. Right? so this is a problem. But at the same time, I understood taking a life of a person or hurting a life of a person is completely forbidden. So this is how I was raised in, right? So whatever you do not harm another human being. So these things just became toys to me that I just play with and then I'm off.
Right? How can you convince a child that don't harm other people no matter what you do?
Sometimes it's just simple. In the same way that you speak to a child, you say, in the same way, you don't want anyone to harm you, you should not harm others. Would you like me to beat you? Would you like me to slap you? Would you like me to, you know, cause you pain? The child will say no. Then it's simple, you should not do it to others. And it's the hadith of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa sallam. It's like love for others which you love for yourself. The same thing.
Thanks, Sayyid Abdullah. It was, as always, very enlightening talking to you in regards to violence. So that's today's program for you. If you missed it, don't worry. You can always download an archive of this episode and previous ones from our website. Simply visit parstoday.com and click on Call of Islam. You'll find Islamic Upbringing right there. You can also find us on various social media platforms. Simply search Call of Islam Radio on Instagram, YouTube, Telegram, and Twitter. And you can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. That's englishradio@irib.ir. Until next episode, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Israel has launched a massive bombing campaign against the Gaza Strip in what is undoubtedly the most brutal offensive since the 2014 war. As Israel enters its second week of indiscriminate bombings, Hundreds of Palestinians have been martyred, and many more wounded, with figures climbing into the thousands of injured. The collective mainstream media and Western governments have attempted to portray the onslaught as a mere crisis and to provide cover for Israel's crimes. On this program, we seek to expose those crimes and report the real story that Israel doesn't want you to see. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. On May 10th, 2021, Israel began an offensive against the Gaza Strip, bombing the Palestinian enclave by land and by air. For several weeks prior, tensions were growing rapidly in occupied Palestine as Israeli forces cracked down on Palestinian protesters. The protests first began at Damascus Gate in Jerusalem as a result of restrictions that Israel had imposed on Palestinians during the holy month of Ramadan, as well as Israel's plans to evict Palestinian families living in the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. Earlier that day, on May 10th, Israeli forces stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque, firing tear gas and rubber-coated bullets at Palestinians while they were inside praying, leaving over 90 people injured. Israel's desecration of Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is the third holiest site in Islam, drew widespread condemnation and rebuke from Muslims and non-Muslims alike. As a result, the Palestinian resistance group Hamas, which is also in power in the Gaza Strip, issued an ultimatum, demanding that Israel immediately withdraw from Al-Aqsa Mosque. Israel ignored this, and Hamas responded shortly thereafter with rocket fire. Israel then began an offensive against Gaza, launching several airstrikes which have continued every day since May 10th. Thousands of Israeli reservists were called up, and there was a genuine fear that a ground invasion was about to take place. Just like in previous wars against Gaza in 2009 and 2014, Israel has been purposely targeting public and health infrastructure in Palestine. This is a war crime under the Geneva Convention. As a result of Israel's bombings, the only salination plant in the Gaza Strip has been put out of action. The only clinic that is able to carry out COVID-19 tests has also been damaged. 6 out of 10 electricity lines have been cut. As if the electricity situation wasn't already bad enough to begin with, people living in Gaza can get barely 4 to 5 hours of power a day. According to the Palestinian Water Authority, water supplies in Gaza have now been reduced by 40% as a result of the Israeli bombardments. Gaza's water infrastructure has been hit so severely that human waste and sewage are now overflowing onto the streets. Israel has also bombed the main roads that lead to Al-Shifa Hospital, making it more difficult for the wounded to reach the biggest hospital in the Gaza Strip. The Palestinian Health Ministry reported that one of its clinics was put out of action. Doctors Without Borders also reported damage to their clinic, and there are photographs all over Gaza of roads completely decimated. Health workers and residents alike describe horrific scenes of seeing loved ones and neighbors buried alive under the rubble, of digging out the deceased from underneath twisted metal and slabs of concrete. The result of Israeli warplanes indiscriminately bombing Gaza. A nurse at Al-Shifa Hospital told Al Jazeera that she had, quote, never seen anything like this in her life. There were body parts collected on hospital beds and unbearable scenes. On May 15th, an Israeli airstrike hit the offices of the Associated Press and Al Jazeera in Gaza. There were no deaths or injuries. However, despite several pleas from the Associated Press for Israel not to bomb the building and to allow them to gather belongings, they were ignored. And the entire 12-story building was leveled by Israeli warplanes as the entire world watched it collapse into rubble. Israel is openly bombing the buildings of some of the largest news outlets on the planet, and the so-called liberal democracies of the West say nothing and shrug it off like nothing happened. Videos have been pouring out of Gaza, one after the other, showing entire residential buildings collapsing under Israeli bombs. Within the first week, the number of deaths on the Israeli side has amounted to 10 people. On the Palestinian side, hundreds have been killed and thousands more have been injured. The majority of them are civilians, not Hamas. In the first week alone, Israel killed over 212 Palestinians. 61 of them were children. That's almost one-third of the casualties. I repeat, almost one-third of the casualties are children. The Gaza Health Ministry reports that over 1,400 Palestinians have been wounded. The UN says that over 40,000 Palestinians have been displaced and over 2,000 have lost their homes. And just to give you another idea of the level of cruelty and barbarism enacted by the Israelis, in the same week, multiple Palestinian families were wiped out entirely by Israeli bombs. On Friday, May 14th, the entire Tanani family in northern Gaza was killed by an Israeli airstrike, which completely flattened their home. The next day, on May 15th, 10 family members of the Al-Hadidi family were killed by an Israeli airstrike on the Shati refugee camp in Gaza. And this is always the case. Every single time Israel attacks Gaza, the death toll is incomparable. the number of casualties is always so much higher on the Palestinian side. The Israelis have an air force, they have a navy, they have drones, they receive billions in military aid every single year from the U.S. This is asymmetrical warfare at best, and it's a bloodbath at worst. Joining me is Dina Almouti. She's a trauma-informed clinician and has written extensively for Electronic Intifada. Thanks for coming on. It's a privilege to have you, Dina.
The honor is mine. The honor is mine.
Right now in Gaza, almost one-third of the casualties are children. You know, we talk a lot about the killed and the wounded, which is horrific in of itself, but what kind of effect does this violence have on the children who survive? I mean, what does that leave them with?
I guess to me, calling it a war simplifies it. There are no two sides in equal defense of each other. It's a merciless genocide that's being committed against people who are unable to leave, unable to get shelter, unable to get medical attention. You know, it's wholesale slaughter, state-sanctioned genocide. And what effect does that have on an entire population, on generation after generation? It's human devastation on an unimaginable scale. I mean, Palestinian children close their eyes and see nothing but devastation. They open their eyes to the same, and they grow up fluent in a language of grief and trauma. Trauma is like a second language to them, essentially. It rearranges their lives. It interrupts it, if you will, over and over and over again, one onslaught after another. Their thoughts run on death, destruction, calamity. Under those conditions, the chronic traumatic stress becomes so, you know, common that it's their normal. You know, the trauma actually embeds itself in their cells. It alters their DNA. And that passes on one generation after another. It actually becomes generational. So talk about like developmental disruption. That's exactly what Israel is intent on, to disrupt lives, to disrupt the normal progression. It wants to constantly have one assault after another to disrupt a normal development from occurring.
So do we have any figures? Do we know what percentage of children are diagnosed? I mean, what about those who are never diagnosed, who may have some trauma or scars? I mean, do we have any idea of these consequences in terms of numbers?
I would tell people to, you know, to turn to DCI, Defense for Children International. They have amazing figures to, you know, they will document a lot of what's happening. But even then, I feel like that's scratching the surface of what's happening. I mean, even children in Gaza right now who are receiving psychosocial care, you know, for what happened during the last onslaught are being killed. As of, you know, today and yesterday. And so how do you keep up? How do you keep track of who's suffering?
Regarding chemical, biological weapons, we've seen reports that Israel's potentially been using white phosphorus in the last days, and we know they did in 2009. I mean, what does that do to someone whose body, whose brain is still developing?
Oh, the effect that it would have on, like entire generations are going to suffer immeasurable consequences to their immune system, endocrine system, their neurological system. This is all very calculated, mind you. None of it is by accident. It's all very, very calculated and by design. These endocrine disruptors will affect fertility. When I was there in 2014, I saw children born with ambiguous genitalia, with all kinds of cancers. This is affecting so much more than just, you know, what you see on the surface. This is a very generational thing designed to destroy generation after generation after generation, all very calculated, and none of it by accident or just to create destruction on a large scale. It's designed to create destruction for generations to come, even in unborn children, if you will. So it's terribly It's incomprehensible.
So, you know, Dina, lastly, we've seen a massive general strike all across Palestine, perhaps the biggest in Palestinian history. I mean, what are your thoughts on that? Does it make you feel hopeful at all?
I think this is a monumental time in history. We're going to look back, and when people ask, where were you when this or that happened? Were you standing on the right side? Were you standing on the side of the oppressed? Did you choose to make a conscious effort to speak up even when it wasn't as popular or when, you know, wasn't good for your career or what have you? I do have hope. I will always have hope as a Palestinian. I think a lot more needs to be done. We need to see more than lip service. We need more than what's being done, because I feel like this world continues to fail Palestine in every conceivable way, but I do have hope.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Reacting to Israel's latest attacks on Gaza, the response from the majority of Western governments is just as you'd expect. Lackluster at best, and at worst, a complete whitewashing of Israeli crimes. Some European countries thought that it would be a wise idea to take a side, and of course they decided to pander to the Israeli lobby. Czech President Zeman ordered that an Israeli flag be raised over Prague Castle in a show of solidarity with the Israeli occupation, or as most would correctly put it, in a show of hostility to the Palestinians. The Austrian Chancellor, Sebastian Kurz, also decided to fly the Israeli flag, which was raised over the Chancellery building in the capital, Vienna. Now, to say this was done in extremely poor taste is an understatement. Austria is a neutral country, at least officially, and Vienna has long boasted to be the world's capital of international diplomacy. It's home to one of the United Nations headquarters, the International Atomic Energy Agency, and many other international organizations. And this isn't just about violating supposed neutrality, but this move shows that the Austrian and Czech governments to be on the side of the Israeli occupation, on the side of the oppressors. The United Kingdom's Foreign Minister Dominic Raab condemned Hamas firing rockets at Israel, but of course said nothing of Israel's bombardment of Gaza, which has killed hundreds. This was followed up by a readout from the White House regarding U.S. President Joe Biden's call with Netanyahu, in which Biden reaffirmed Israel's, quote, right to defend itself, whatever that means. Joining me is Jennifer Levenstein. She's a freelance journalist, human rights activist, professor of Middle East Studies, and also works with Eyewitness Palestine. Thank you for taking the time, Jennifer. It's great to have you on.
Thank you for having me.
So, Jennifer, I want to start out with the Biden administration's response to what's happening now in Gaza. What are your thoughts on what Jen Psaki, the White House spokesperson, said, Secretary of State Blinken? I mean, what did you think of their assessment and response to what Israel is doing right now in Palestine?
I think their responses have been absolutely criminal. And I don't honestly know if they are criminal intentionally or whether these two people are just incredibly ignorant. When you hear the President of the United States saying that the aggressor in a conflict has the right to self-defense, there's something very, very wrong with that response. The aggressor in any military situation is not the one defending itself. So I've been very disappointed both with his response and also with Secretary of State Antony Blinken's response, who said yesterday that there was no equivalence between the Hamas organization and Israel, and said that Israel had the right to self-defense. So once again, he's got it completely backwards.
Okay, so I mean, what do you say to people who would respond that basically, you know, Palestinians, that Hamas, they're the ones who started everything, and that basically they're responsible for any civilian casualties? I mean, what do you respond to people who say that?
I would say that if they're looking at a situation in a very, very short-term setting, that they can possibly come